Good evening, everybody, and celebration. It's time for the Super Blog Team-Up. Yes, I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge, and this is the long road to ruin. Our submission for The Doctor is in, is the 1998 Eddie Murphy comedy vehicle where he gets to play with animals, Dr. Doolittle. And the hit sequel from 2001, Dr. Doolittle 2. And you might be saying to yourself, hey, weren't there more Dr. Doolittles? There were, but they went straight to video and they don't have Eddie Murphy in them, and no. I gotta draw a line somewhere, folks. So that's what we're doing. That The Doctor is in as part of the Superblog team-up. All the great blogs and podcasts dropped today for the Superblog team-up. And you know, there was Dr. Bong and Dr. Doom and Dr. Doctor and... all the great doctors. And speaking of great doctors, ladies and gentlemen, the doctor is in. It's Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
This was far more fun than I expected it to be.
Yeah, I am considering. I think in my head, I thought these would be more similar to like the Nutty Professor films.
Yeah, same.
Which started off as silly and got progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
But these were delightful.
Well, I mean, I could see why you'd think that, because, and as a little precursor, this is about as close to notes as I've got for these movies, is this was right around the time when Eddie Murphy was undergoing this really kind of out-of-the-blue career revival.
Mm-hmm.
From being a kind of ribald, in-your-face, high-energy, really rated-R comic actor to a pretty bankable linchpin for family films. I really can't remember if this came before or after The Nutty Professor, but I want to say The Nutty Professor came first.
I'm going to look up his filmography. Keep going.
Yeah, I think so. But anyway... Eddie had not really, as I remember it, had a real knock-it-out-of-the-park, touch-em-all hit in quite some time.
Yeah, let me jump in here. Until the late 90s. So he does Coming to America in 1998. It's followed up with Harlem Nights, which
You mean 1988.
Sorry, yeah, I apologize. 1988.
I was going to say...
He follows it up with Harlem Night, which I remember enjoying. It has Richard Pryor in it. I don't remember if it did well or not.
It was okay.
Then another 48 Hours, which was fine, but I don't think it was as nearly as big a hit as the first 48 Hours. Then Boomerang, which I'm pretty sure bombed. Then The Distinguished Gentleman, which I don't even remember. And then Beverly Hills Cop 3 to try to get things back on track, and we talked about that years ago. And Vampire in Brooklyn... Keep that in mind, because we'll be doing on trial on that next year, which I think fell flat. And I think that's about where he must have turned to his agent and been like, you got to get me out of this. Things are going badly, because that's when he followed up with The Nutty Professor in 1996.
Now, I think this might have also been well after... the high-profile incident with Eddie and the transgender prostitute.
Yeah, I think you're right about that without looking it up. But just so his career revival, where he sort of switches from edgy comic to Family Guy, starts in earnest with 1996 with The Nutty Professor, which is a huge hit. He follows it up with Metro the following year, and then he hits a triple header with Mulan, Dr. Dolittle, and Holy Man. Mm-hmm. In 99, he does Life and Bowfinger, and one of those ended up doing really well. And then in 2000, Nutty Professor 2, which is another big hit for him, then Shrek, then Dr. Dolittle 2. So up to 2001, he's going pretty strong. Now, it's after this, it's weird, like he did really, really well in the family, you know, from 96 to 2001 in the family genre.
Yeah.
And then it all kind of hit the wall, because in 2002
from Bowfinger and Pluto Nash on downward.
I was going to say 2002 is Showtime, Pluto Nash, and I Spy, and it doesn't get any better after that. Next is Daddy Daycare and the Haunted Mansion, and we don't need to keep doing this, but you get the drift.
Yeah, Dreamgirls was a nice little pleasant surprise of a blip. I think that might have even, I seem to remember, I think that got him either an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor or at least talk of it.
I will say this. I mean, he does about a movie a year. Really, he's been doing about a movie a year for like 20 years. But solidly for at least the previous 10. And it's up and down. I mean, Norbit's in there. That was ugh. But he's also got, you know, Shrek the Third, which was a solid hit for him. Meet Dave, Imagine That, Shrek Forever, Tower Heist, 1,000
Words.
Wow,
I completely forgot about Donkey.
But here, right before Coming to America, which Jason and I reviewed earlier this year, he did one of my favorite movies in recent memory, Dolomite Is My Name, which was the biopic about Rudy Ray Moore. It's fan-fucking-tastic. So, yes. But it started in earnest in 1996 and quickly followed up in 1998 with some solid hits, not the least of which was Dr. Dolittle.
You know, he's one of those guys where you can really age yourself by what you remember Eddie Murphy for.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I was when we reviewed Coming to America, I actually talked about like being at the drive-in movie with my parents seeing 48 Hours. I think that was a double feature. Like, we went to go see Flashdance and 48 Hours on the same night. Now, you might be asking yourself, how old could you have possibly been when 48 Hours came out? Not old enough to be at the drive-in with my parents, but there I was.
See, but again, that's so jarring. And I'm not going to do one of those, this came out just many years ago, do you feel old? Yeah, I'm not going to do that. I hate that noxious, pretentious bullshit. But it is jarring on a certain level to think that there's a whole generation that remembers Eddie Murphy as the guy in Dr. Dolittle and, Nutty Professor and The Clumps, Haunted Mansion, and those being like the movies mom would put on to shut the little crotch dumplings up for an hour and a half so she could go have a glass of wine or two and some peace and quiet, like halfway across the house. Or movies that would be on in like a pediatrician or a dentist's office or something. And then you go back about 10 years further and you got a whole separate generation that remembers that this guy who in the late 90s, early 2000s was this bastion of these saccharine family-friendly films.
So imagine being like my dad's age. He's in his 70s and knew Eddie Murphy as the guy doing Buckwheat on SNL during the golden age of comedy.
Yeah. The guy who kind of picked up the Richard Pryor torch.
Right.
And was one of the guys without whom, you know, if there's no Eddie Murphy, we don't get a Steve Harvey, Cedric the Entertainer, Chris Rock, D.L. Hughley,
Dave
Chappelle, all these legendary black comics, and probably about a dozen more that I'm blanking on off the top of my head because I've been up since 4 a.m.
I mean, look at how many people, black and white, cite delirious and raw as instrumental in developing them as comedians.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was really one of the first and biggest real lightning in a bottle rocket strapped to his back stars that SNL created.
What's interesting is like I remember his bit, you know, because you had on the one side you had Cosby and you say Cosby now and all everyone thinks is the rape.
Yeah.
Cosby was a whole human being before any of that came out. And let's focus on that. It's a horrible thing that he did, and he's rightly punished for it. But before all that, he was a comedian. He was, like, America's dad. So, like, up until a few years ago, that's all we knew him as.
There's an argument that a lot of that might have been a little bit of, you know, the Huxtable doth protest too much as far as maybe trying to overcompensate for everything.
Well, that's what I was saying. Like you have Red Fox, who's sort of like really like the beginning of all of it. And then you have like two divergent paths out of Red Fox. One is sort of the spiritual successor to him, who's Richard Pryor. And then you have Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as those paths are sort of diverging, they kind of come back together with Eddie Murphy, who's sitting there struggling with, well, on the one hand, you have this perceived moral compass of Bill Cosby saying, probably shouldn't use the N-word so much, probably shouldn't be so filthy. And he talked about this in one of his shows, actually. It's why I remember it so well. And then there's Richard Pryor going, are you making people laugh? Are they happy? Are you happy? Well, then tell Bill, have a Coke and a smile and shut the fuck up.
Well, yeah, but then again, at the time, you also didn't exactly have a Hannibal Buress, mm-hmm. who was saying, what was he said on stage one time, said, yeah, well, you rape women, so shut the fuck up.
Right.
Because nobody was really willing to tell Kaz off like that.
Right.
But it was kind of the worst kept hidden in plain sight secret in Hollywood.
That's the fun thing about Eddie Murphy, is that despite himself, he has been at times the spiritual successor to Richard Pryor and the spiritual successor to Bill Cosby. Because was there any other black male comedian in the, you know, late 80s, mid to late 90s that captured, and this is what we're talking about, you know, a film in 1998 that's like right in the heart of him doing family comedies. So Eddie Murphy has been all of those things. He's been the guy that, you know, they can come into your home and entertain your children and be as clean as the day is long as this Dr. Dolittle movie is that we're about to talk about. And then there's, you know, he's been the royal penis is clean, Your Highness. You know? Just a tad filthy.
I don't know, and I mean, coincidentally, he's in this movie with him prominently. Chris Rock might be about the closest for that period that you get, because I mean, you could maybe make an argument for Martin Lawrence, but I don't think Martin ever really kind of walked in both comedic worlds quite as comfortably as those two did.
I can't, and I'd have to go back and look at his filmography, which I'm not doing. But I don't know. So the thing with Eddie Murphy is he did what the Jim Carreys and the Robin Williams of the world did, was he was able to do drama, he was able to do comedy, he was able to do raunchy comedy, he was able to do family comedy. Eddie Murphy could stretch as an actor. They don't get much better than him. They really don't. Martin Lawrence.
Martin was one note.
Yeah, I don't think Martin Lawrence could ever do anything outside of being, you know, over the top silly.
If you saw Martin on, well, Martin, you saw a really watered down of pretty much the only thing Martin Lawrence could do.
Yeah, like I don't recall there being a lot of like stepping out and doing like a dramatic role. Maybe he tried. No, I'm just not. I mean, maybe life, might be the only thing I can think of.
You know, that kind of brings Bernie Mac to mind.
Oh, Bernie Mac was great. Bernie Mac was taken from us way too young.
Oh yeah, yeah. But even him though. I mean, granted, yeah, you got a movie like Life where he could play like maybe a little more serious, but Bernie was kind of just Bernie the same way, you know, anytime you see Steve Harvey, that's just Steve Harvey.
Mm. I don't know. I would give credit to Bernie Mac's acting chops. I mean, did he do a lot of Hamlet?
Oh, no.
No, but I think Bernie Mac could act the side.
Oh,
you know,
no. I'm
pants
not,
off his,
don't,
some of
don't
his
get
criticism.
Me wrong. I'm not trying to diminish Bernie mm-hmm. by any means. I laugh just as hard at let me explain the word motherfucker as I do at some of the more heartwarming moments of the Bernie Mac show.
Anyway, so yeah. But yeah, we don't get any of these people without Red Fox, and we certainly don't get any of these people without Ben Cosby, Pryor, and then Eddie Murphy, who, you know, I think Eddie Murphy is sort of that flashpoint where if you know, it's Eddie Murphy who begets, like, the next 2-3 generations of black comics. And without him, I don't know if we ever get that far.
No.
And he is standing on the shoulders of the three giants that I mentioned.
See, and here, if you really want a testament to his brilliance, here he is taking what was really a 1967 flop that achieved a cult following over the course of decades, which was based on a series of novels first published in 1920, and he takes this and with the first movie in particular, he really mines this for some gold.
So let me say this. I'm going to read the plot synopsis, and then we can talk about it, and then we'll rinse repeat with the second one. But here's the thing about Eddie Murphy, because I was thinking about, like, The Haunted Mansion and some of the other ones he does where things start to go off the rails for him. When Eddie Murphy is composed, mm-hmm. Eddie Murphy is absolutely capable of subtle humor. Eddie Murphy is absolutely capable of solid, subtle, reined-in performance. The same way that, like, Robin Williams is, mm-hmm. if you look at some of the dramas that he's done. You know, like, Robin Williams obviously isn't doing The Genie when he's doing Good Will Hunting.
See, and that's interesting, because you say subtle and reined in. I kind of look at more as Eddie and Robin, when they were in different kinds of comedies, mm-hmm. they kind of knew how to really take the marrow of who they were as comedians and just kind of adapt it and remold it. Because, yeah, here, you know, Eddie Murphy's not doing Billy Valentine. He's not doing Axel Foley. But, I mean, in his delivery, you can certainly hear the little undernotes mm-hmm. of what made Eddie.
Here's the thing. Look at some of the ones that did not do as well, where Eddie Murphy had a tendency, God bless him, to sometimes be a little too overly reliant on the more bombastic parts of his comedy and his personality, and that's what more of what I'm referring to.
I can see that.
So you take Dr. Doolittle, which was directed by Betty Thomas, and she did a really good job of handling him. She took, you know, she was like, hey, you're this really super educated doctor, and you have a superpower that you've been hiding all of these years because, you know, you were convinced as a child that this would be a bad thing. But this is complex for you because as it starts to come out, you are compelled to do the right thing, even though it may upend your world. And there's a place where he could have gone super silly with it, and that's where honestly that's what I was afraid of with this. When I watched this with my kids the first time, I was like, holy shit, this is actually much better than I thought it would be. And that's because Eddie Murphy plays the character as written and doesn't just take it to Sillyville. And even in the second one, I mean, it's a little bit more of the same, and we'll talk about that momentarily, but he doesn't go Haunted Mansion with it. And Haunted Mansion is probably the best example I can think of where Eddie Murphy was like unrestrained and just went crazy and thought he was being funny, and it just comes off bad.
Eddie takes this character and really leans into the heart of him.
He does.
Yeah.
All right, so it's 1968. 5-year-old John Doolittle, who is Eddie Murphy, displays an ability to hear what animals are saying, starting with his own dog. John asks his dog questions like, why do dogs sniff each other's butts? The dog's response, like you would do, the dog's response is that it's their own way of shaking hands, and he does it when he's meeting his new principal. His behavior horrifies his father, Archer. Archer hires a local priest to perform an exorcism on John in order to remove the devil from him, but during the exam, the dog bites and attacks the man, resulting in Archer sending the dog away. Following this ordeal, John eventually stops talking to animals. 30 years later, in 1998, John becomes a doctor and a surgeon while living in San Francisco, California. He is happily married to his wife, Lisa, and has two daughters, typical teenager Charisse and nerdy Maya. Charisse is played by Raven Simone, who has a pet guinea pig named Rodney, who is played by Chris Rock, and what she believes is a swan egg, which she hopes will bond with her upon hatching. A large medical company owned by Mr. Calloway seeks to buy John's practice, a deal in which one of his colleagues, Dr. Mark Weller, played by Oliver Platt, is enthusiastic about. Their other colleague, Dr. Gene Rice, is skeptical about the deal due to the potential of downsizing patients and staff. John's family goes on vacation, but he goes back to work to see a patient and then pick up Rodney. Unfortunately, on his way home, he accidentally nearly hits a dog with his SUV, causing the dog to shout at him in anger. Afterwards, Rodney starts talking to John, causing him to believe he is having a mental breakdown. John has a CT scan after animals start asking for favors when he helps a wounded owl and then unwittingly adopts the dog he ran over, eventually naming him Lucky. John starts secretly helping various animals, including a suicidal circus tiger named Jake. And Jake is played by Albert Brooks. Who suffers great cerebral vein. Through all of this, John begins learning to reappreciate his gift, at one point confiding to both Lucky and Mark that he has never felt excited about his work in years. Lisa and Mark catch him performing CPR on a rat and have him sectioned in a mental hospital. Believing his gift is a hindrance, John rejects all abnormality in his life and returns to work, but in doing so ostracizes Maya as well, who comes to believe he doesn't like her. Maya admits to Archer that she liked the idea of her father talking to animals. John has a change of heart when he eavesdrops on the conversation. He admits to Maya that he does not like but loves her for who she is and encourages her to continue being what she wants to be. John then apologizes to Lucky, and together they sneak Jake out of the circus to perform surgery on him. Mark and Gene catch John, but Gene is sympathetic of the former's opportunistic attitude. Archer reveals to Lisa that John's gift is real, encouraging her to venture into the operating theater and keep Jake calm while John and Gene remove the cause of pain, saving Jake's life. John then declines Calloway's offer to buy the place and officially accepts his gift of talking to animals. John becomes both a doctor and a veterinarian afterwards, embracing his ability to talk to animals. Maya's egg hatches into a baby alligator. All right, Sean. I kind of gave some of my thoughts about the movie, so I'll take a pause to breathe and take a drink, and then you tell me, what did you think of the picture overall?
Overall, God, it has so much more heart than I gave it credit for. I kept coming back to that word. And it comes from the fact that it doesn't lean in to contrivance or predictability as much as it does trying to kind of hold the throttle on John a little bit and keep him relatable, despite this obviously kind of silly madcap premise. But it also helps that he's got some really superb characters to play off, and a really outstanding cast too. Ozzie Davis, as he always is just like a big walking, talking, warm hug as Grandpa Archer. You've got Raven Simone, who I would argue, I mean, obviously, you know, full grown woman now, and it's almost this whole, almost, I feel bad almost calling her this, but really probably one of the most talented, intelligent child actors of all time. Somebody who's always had tremendous range. Here she's playing an angsty teenager, but she doesn't really turn that volume up to 11. like you would have seen in a lot of, in a lot of movies. She feels like just kind of a real standoffish teen. You've got Chris Rock, who is just mile a minute charm as Rodney. It's easy to forget that this was also in the midst of the unbelievable Norm MacDonald revenge on NBC executives tour, in which he seemed absolutely determined to throw that whole "you're just not very funny" thing just back in as many faces as possible. And yet he doesn't manage to overdo it on the obnoxious snark. He's another one who's kind of able to tone down his signature persona just enough. And, you know, it never feels like it really lingers on jokes or gags for too long, to the point where they wear out their welcome. And best of all, it never feels preachy either. Like not for a single moment. Yeah, it's got very much an embrace who you are, follow your heart kind of message. But, you know, you never feel at any point like you're being talked down to, and the humor hits this neat little kind of equilibrium where it's, you know, silly and maybe sometimes a little bit gross enough to keep kids giggling, but it's easy for full grown adults like you and I to still kind of sit back and smirk at it. And this was not a golden age for family friendly movies necessarily in terms of being able to do that. We had a few that did it really well, but we also had a lot that just they bordered on condescending. Was what they really were. But like we will occasionally kind of joke on trial about how, well, you know, the movie doesn't have to be particularly smart because it's for this audience. We joke about that, but at the same time, that's a cop-out defense. It's a way to try to salvage shit, for the most part, when that gets broken out, because you can point to movies like this and a handful of others that you never get the feeling really talked down to anyone there. It's just, it might have come out when I was maybe a little bit too old to fully appreciate it. I was in high school at the time, but by the same stretch, I kind of envy the parents who had to look for a movie to take their kids to, and this was one of the choices, because I mean, man, you could have done a whole lot worse.
Yeah, I like what you said about it not being preachy, because the story is ultimately about a guy who's lost his way, and you know, he's become sort of swallowed up in his work and sort of detached from his family, despite himself. You know, he loves his wife, he loves his children. This isn't a guy, you know, who, you know, this isn't nobody. You know, like I may have overcorrected. This isn't a situation, you know, or like an American. Oh gosh, Kevin Spacey, where he wants to bang the teenager.
American Beauty.
Thank you. Yep. You know, it's not an American Beauty where, you know, this is a tale of a man who, you know, who hates his life. It's none of that. It's a guy who just, you know, life has a tendency to carry you away, and sometimes you lose a connection to the things you love. And he finds that connection by getting back in touch with the superpower that he has, which makes him open up and be a more humane person and remember what that's like. Not an uncommon thing among the medical professionals from what I've learned over the years, that you can absolutely forget why you're doing what you wanted to do in the first place, why you wanted to help people.
You know, I mean, it's early on, there's a bit of narration from, mm-hmm. I want to say it was Lucky, before we ever meet Lucky, about how John became miserable. And when I heard that, my eyes kind of narrowed. I went, oh, are we really going to make Eddie Murphy full on detestable here?
Right.
And they don't. I was thinking we were going to be like going, you know, full on Gordon Bombay in the first 30 minutes of the Mighty Ducks bad.
Yeah.
Not so much. Not so much.
No, I mean, he's just a guy doing a thing. And yeah. Like I said, he's sort of adrift. And you know,
he was materialistic, sure, but you know, I never got the impression he was exactly loathsome.
No, and you know, and he's not cruel to his children. I mean, he's there, he's involved, and so that's one of the things I really liked about this. You know, you talked about it not being preachy, and sure, there are just certain tropes in a family movie where you know, especially as Hollywood tends to present itself despite itself. And what I mean by that is there's so much of the money is the root of all evil, and wouldn't it be better if we all just loved each other and cared about each other and money was not the central issue? And I'm like, yeah, you're all rich, though. Shut up. not really interested in hearing that from you, but it's a kid's movie. My daughter is the right age to be a communist right now. You know, when we did the Tom and Jerry commentary, she talked about, you know, the main character is primarily interested in maintaining her her wealth and inheritance, and you know, and there's a song about money, 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 and my daughter's like, this is the worst song ever. I hate these people. You know, money is terrible. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. And you absolutely have the right at 10 years old to be a hardcore communist. When you have when you're an adult and you actually have to pay for shit, come back to me and see how you feel about that. But you know, but that's the thing. That's so many kids. That's it's the rare kid that tends to fall into sort of, you know, conservative thought. Most kids are like far left, you know, kind of thinking individuals, as you know, as they should be. What is the phrase? And I don't mean this as an insult kind of a thing, but it is a phrase that's out there and people say it. You know, if you're young and not on the left, you have no heart. If you're old and not a conservative, you have no brain. I mean, so it's there. It's in the movie. It's in like every kid's movie for the most part, but they handle it with a deftness so that it's not overly preachy. It doesn't hit you over the head. It doesn't make you ashamed for having a nice car or anything like that. It's a device to move things along, which is fine. I absolutely agree with you. I think Raven Simone, for the little bit that she's given to do, she's given a lot more to do in the second one, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But here, you know, where she's, you know, she's kind of reminds me of the daughter from Mad About You towards the end. I mean, at the very end of the show, they sort of flash forward to her being a teenager, and she's like, "My name is Sonia." It's one of the things I don't know if you ever watched Mad About You.
I watched, I think, early and middle Mad About You, but I don't think I ever saw the later seasons.
So I think the series finale, they show Mabel through the years, and it's narrated by Janine Garofalo, who is Mabel as an adult, and Mabel is Paul and Helen Hunt's daughter, and mm-hmm. You know, they show her as a teenager, and of course, again, her name is Mabel, and she's like, "You can call me Sonia." So when Charisse is like, "You call me whatever it is," whatever name she came up with, I'm like, "Huh,
Paprika."
Yeah. I'm like, "Oh, this must be a thing in writers' rooms that they think teenagers do," which is fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Raven Simone, capable child actress, no problem there. I think if I have to give this movie a criticism, because again, I like the animal interactions, they really. Really walk the line of making sure the animals were funny and engaging, and you know, were used as comic fodder, but did not go over the top to where the animals almost become annoying. They really were able to, like I said, there's a level of restraint to this movie that I seldom seen in this kind of movie. And I was shocked by that because I really expecting this to be ridiculous.
I couldn't think of any that really became patently obnoxious. And in fact, quite the opposite. I thought Albert Brooks's performance was quite touching.
No, that's what I'm saying. I think they all did a great job, and I think the movie does a great job of, I'm going to use the phrase reined in again, of keeping everybody reined in. The animals I think the animals hit the right pitch. I think the only one that maybe overdoes it might be Chris Rock, but that just might be how the character was written, and there's so little of it that it's not that bad.
Yeah, and... But I think a lot of why that worked so well was the performers. I got the feeling they didn't over-direct them too much.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of gave them the script, gave them some idea of roughly what they wanted, and then they just let them inject their own natural personalities.
I'm actually wondering, and I don't know this for certain, but I'm taking a wild guess here, that there's a lot of footage on the cutting room floor of, you know, various levels of over the top, and that an editor sat down and was like, we're going to make, because this is 85 minutes, we don't even make the 90 minute mark on this, and an editor kind of sat with this and was like, all right, let's get to the fucking point here, let's cut the fat, let's do what we need to do.
Oh, but come on, you know there had to be some great outtakes between Gary Shandling and Julie Kavner.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure there's Chris Rock doing just wild and crazy stuff. I hope he went into Can I Have One Rib at one point. but none of that needs to be in the movie is my point.
No. I get you. But no, I mean you just kind of take a couple of old pros like Gary and Julie and just let them be Gary and Julie. Right. You've got Jenna Elfman, Norm Macdonald, Chris Rock, Albert Brooks,
John Leguizamo.
John Leguizamo.
Paul Rubens.
Who's got to be? Yeah, I almost forgot Paul Rubens was in this. And for the record, John's got to be one of the most underrated, not just comic actors, but just overall.
And of course, the greatest voice actor of our age, Gilbert Godfrey.
Yes. We shall never forget the cat.
I am going to mourn heavily the day he leaves his mortal coil. There is never going to be anyone like him, and there has been no one like him till he came along. He is such a weird, unique, wonderful individual, Gilbert Godfrey.
He's a one-trick pony, but he does that one trick really fucking well.
Have you ever heard his stand-up? His stand-up's hilarious.
That's all right. It's not my thing.
Okay.
But no, I mean, you get the sense that nobody really has to be over under direct. There's a nice little bit with Eddie and Jeffrey Tambor in the vet's office, and then let's just throw Norm Macdonald in his prime, just for a cherry on top. Like I said, you got Ozzie Davis, who just makes every room feel like a warm summer's day any scene he's in.
I want to talk real quick about the bit with the tiger, because once you get into the thing of, hey, we want to make money, but I want to be, you know, but I want to help animals. Okay, but what is the central thing going to be? What is this all going to rest on? And they decided to rest it on, here's this vicious tiger who's terribly sick, and no one knows what to do with it. No one even realizes how sick it is until he comes along with his superpower. Mm-hmm. And I really, you talk about Albert Brooks giving a good voice performance. The character, weirdly enough, of the tiger is one of my favorites in the whole movie. And the way that they handled the surgery scene, which again, I have to give a lot of credit to the team who put this movie together, between the writing and the directing and the acting, because that scene is really pitch perfect. And I'll tell you, it's a linchpin for the whole movie, because if that scene... Because here's the thing, like, they do something like that a little bit earlier with the rat, but the rat scene has to be so stupid and has to be so bad that, you know, it sets him to his lowest point where he has to go to the psych hospital with the terribly obnoxious Paul Giamatti. Holy cow. That, what I mean, if there's a villain in this movie, I know it's supposed to be Oliver Platt, but oy, Paul Giamatti was terrible. Like,
he might be one of the few characters where I genuinely, when all was said and done, just went, was there a reason you were even there? Did you really contribute anything?
Well, he's so slimy, you know? Like, you know, Oliver Platt plays the character, you know, with a certain degree of urgency, and, you know, he's trying to make money. He's an adult man, you know, in a rock'em sock'em profession. Like, I get where Oliver Platt's coming from.
Yeah, Giamatti was just a completely random former classmate with an axe to grind.
Yeah, well, I mean, and he's just played as a vicious dick for I don't know what reason.
Yeah.
Anyway, but... You know, so the scene with I accept the silliness of the rat scene. One, because Eddie Murphy doesn't go full on Haunted Mansion in that scene. He was starting to. I was starting to see him go a little nuts. And I'm like, oh, no. It's like listening to an orchestra and somebody suddenly starts, you know, like missing notes. You're like, no. It was all going so well. But he kept it restrained. He you know, he was like, I got to save this rat. And not, oh, I got to save the rat! Which is what I was afraid it was going to turn into. You know, none of that. So yeah, that I'm okay with that. But the scene of him saving the tiger is what really sells the movie, what really puts it over the top, and it's handled pitch perfect. And you know, a different set of people under different circumstances, and I don't know if it works as well. And so I have to give them credit, because that's a scene that balances on a knife. It can go so bad so fast.
And it went so well.
Any other thoughts about this movie? I'm just going to kind of give you my final piece, then I'll let you have the last word. I really, really like this. My kids really, really like this. It's short, sweet, to the point. Restrained, which I like. It is delightful. And it's hard to criticize, because there's like no one gives a bad performance. I keep saying everyone kind of toes the line to where it, you know, where the pitches are good. They're not overly pitchy, or, you know, overly bombastic to the point where, you know, people are like banging the scenery and stuff like that. Like some of the complaints I've made about other movies. This was a shock. I did not expect this to be as simply delightful as it was.
It's tonally ideal. You have not just a loaded cast, but a cast with some superb chemistry. 99 times out of 100 throughout the movie, it knows when to kind of ratchet up the energy and when to pull it back. And it's better and is more fulfilling than it has any right being on paper. Absolutely, 100% check it out.
And it was a smash hit. It had a budget of $71.5 million, and it made almost $300 million in 1998 money. So, you know, good on ya. Mm-hmm. You don't get much better than that. Not for this kind of movie, not for that time.
Yeah, so, but for that time, if a movie made that kind of money, it was guaranteed there was going to be a sequel that misses the point entirely.
And there was in 2001.
Yeah.
actually, before we do that, let me go ahead and pay some bills here. Folks, you know, we've been talking about it every show, and we will continue to do so because it really is a great service. And that is Grammarly. For you listeners of Long Road to Ruin, and for you fans of the Superblog team up, right over here on the Rattlington Broadcasting Network on W2M, Grammarly is offering a free download of the Grammarly software. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes, while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, check out our link at getgrammarly.com/WTM network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M network. And if you're sitting there driving in a car, be like, I got to get on that Grammarly shit that he's talking about. The link is in the description of your podcast. So simply at the red light, instead of drag racing with the guy next to you, look down at your phone, press the link in the description, and it'll take you where you need to go. Speaking of where we need to go, we need to move on to 2001, the Space Odyssey. No. And Dr. Doolittle 2. And the premise of this one is there's a bear. Well, I'm going to read it to you, but it focuses around trying to get a bear to mate with Lisa Kudrow, not the actress, but you know the voice of the bear.
that would be a completely different movie.
Infinitely more interesting.
With a very specific audience, there is no guessing about who that movie was made for.
Could you imagine, you know, on a very special episode of Friends, Phoebe?
Oh god, we have to follow up the Grammarly hat with a beast. There goes that sponsorship. It was nice while it lasted.
Smelly bear, I love you, smelly bear. Phoebe, what are you doing? Anyway, so the cast returned. We have Eddie Murphy, Raven Simone, Kristen Wilson, who we didn't talk about in the first movie. She plays wife, and she plays wife just fine. And we added Jeffrey Jones and Kevin Pollak to the cast. Norm MacDonald returned. This one was directed by Steve Carr. And it takes place 3 years after the events of the first film. Veterinarian Dr. John Doolittle, ability to talk to animals, has made him famous. And he travels the world performing his skills. Returning home from France, he gives his daughter Maya, who's Kyla Pratt, a chameleon named Pepito, who is voiced by Jacob Vargas, and punishes his other daughter, Charisse, who is Raven Simone again, for doing poorly in school, confiscating her phone for a week. Charisse's boyfriend, Eric, who is played by Lil Zane, joins the family for Charisse's 16th birthday, where a possum, the voice of Isaac Hayes, and a raccoon, Joey, the voice of Michael Rapaport, tell John that their boss, the God Beaver, wants to see him. John meets the God Beaver, who is voiced by Richard C. Sarafian, and agrees to save the forest from being cut down by meeting an endangered female Pacific Western bear with a male, like you do. At a circus, John persuades Archie, who is voiced by Steve Zahn, the sole surviving Pacific Western male, to accompany him to the forest and become a real bear. John takes his family on a month-long vacation to the forest, where he makes a deal with the sole surviving Pacific Western female bear named Ava, who is Lisa Kudrow, who is involved with a male Kodiak bear named Sonny, who is voiced by Mike Epps. She agrees not to make any decisions for a month after John promises to turn Archie into a bear she will love. Struggling to train Archie, who is used to the pampered lifestyle, John hires the local forest creatures to chaperone Charisse and Eric, and neglects his wife, Lisa. After assuring Archie that he will find a way to win Ava's heart, John attempts to win Lisa back by dancing in their cabin, with every animal in the forest watching. But Lucky the dog accidentally ruins it. Archie attempts to get Ava's attention by imitating John singing, but falls from a tree. Humiliated, he refuses to leave his newfound cave, but becomes frustrated with John's insults and knocks him into a muddy hole, finally listening to his inner bear. Later, Archie spends the day with Ava, whose relationship with Sonny is declining. Lucky tries to woo a female wolf, successfully urinating around her territory, but is interrupted by one of her packmates before she agrees to go out with him. Meanwhile, Sonny forces Ava to leave Archie. Logging magnate Mr. Potter, who's Jeffrey Jones, attempts to make a deal with John, until Archie tells John he has prepared his big finish to win Ava and goes after a beehive at the edge of a tall hill, ignoring John's warnings and attacking the bees. He manages to get the hive, finally winning Ava's heart and respect of the other forest animals. Ava then dumps Sonny, finally having had enough of all of his rudeness to Archie. In a game of hide-and-seek with Ava, Archie is shot by a tranquilizer dart from Mr. Potter's apprentice, and John learns that Archie had somewhat destroyed the back of a restaurant. After getting information from a weasel, Andy Dick, John visits Archie in jail, telling him that he may be too dangerous to go free and will be sold to a Mexican circus, ending John's chance of saving the forest. John realizes that Charisse has developed her father's gift of talking to animals, reigniting his determination to save the forest. He rallies the animals of the forest not to give up without a fight and free Archie. The animals, led by Charisse, Eric, Maya, rebel against the loggers, and word of Archie's predicament spreads, leading animals around the world to go on strike. Potter and his apprentice are attacked by the animals, and Mr. Potter is cornered by Ava and Joey, forcing him to negotiate with John and the animals. When the animals refuse Mr. Potter's new deal, the strike continues to grow, with several animals, pros, including racehorses and Shamu, getting in on the act. Finally, a deal is made, and the Doolittles and animals accept, freeing Archie and saving the entire forest outside of San Francisco. John and Cerise become closer, talking with and helping animals together, while Archie and Ava mate, and have two cubs, the voices of Frankie Muniz and Mandy Moore. All right, Sean, this one not as good. Not bad.
Well, that's because this was no longer Eddie's movie. In the first movie, you could tell that the stakes for John were a lot more personal and internal to go along with, and in fact, sometimes even overshadow everything that was going on externally. Here, John Doolittle becomes a supporting character to, you know, Archie and Ava. That's all there is to it. We've gone from the first one being one of those rare family movies that knows when to ease off the gas a little bit, to now this one really just kind of buying fully into the stereotypical formula.
I'm going to ask you a question real quick. Kind of weird, kind of off the beaten path, but I'm going somewhere with this. Did you ever see Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion?
Aware of it, never seen it.
Okay. I want you to finish your point, but we're going to have to come back then to how Lisa Kudrow was really misused in this.
Yeah, Eddie becomes a supporting character. That's all there is to it. There's in a movie called Dr. Doolittle 2, there really ends up being precious little investment in Dr. freaking Doolittle. we maybe touch every now and then on a little bit of the tension between him and Charisse, and John really not being particularly fond of Charisse's new boyfriend. And yeah, the reveal in the end that her own gift has started to manifest. While, you know, if you know what to look for, it was kind of already being given away throughout the movie. It just feels flat, empty, tacked on. It felt like Eddie was there just collecting a check. Like he wasn't really invested in it. And when he's kind of the face, the reason for the whole franchise, that's not good. That's not good. The performances around him are still just fine, including the voices, especially Steve Zahn. But otherwise, this is just a case of whose movie is this anyway?
I actually think that's a really great point, Sean. I think you were dead on, 100% right. The problem is they shifted the focus from Eddie Murphy and his growth and his trial and tribulations to this was a movie about Steve Zahn, who's Archie the bear, and Here's the problem with that. Archie's not a great character. You know, he has an arc. It's fine. He has some growth. So it's not the worst writing I've ever seen. It's just... Here's the thing. If you've decided that this isn't going to be about Dr. John, and this is instead going to be about Archie the Bear, then Archie the Bear has to sing. Archie the Bear has to be somebody that you can really get behind and root for. And what you want to see Archie succeed in doing has to be something you as an audience can really buy into. You're being asked to buy into a bear meeting with another bear so that a forest doesn't get deforested.
Archie is just you're by the numbers fish out of water character.
Yeah.
From you know so many other movies. And so it kind of that's kind of why it ceases feeling so much like a Dr. Doolittle sequel and more like, and for all I know this might have been the case, of hey, we had this script, this idea for a movie, but it was missing something, so we decided to just rejigger a few things, move a few pieces around, and all of a sudden, et voila, it's a Dr. Doolittle sequel.
I'm all for saving the trees. I'm all for not, you know, clear-cutting entire forests and depriving the world of precious oxygen. I get it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm really not, you know, I feel like there's a balance between, you know, we need trees for paper and shit, and we need trees for air. The idea of we got to get this bear to bang another bear. That's it. That's what this movie is about. Get this bear to be a manly bear, so that Lisa Kudrow the bear will have sex with him. And I'm like,
And the truth is, you don't even need Eddie Murphy to play right. The part that Eddie plays in this. You could have shoehorned anybody, any character.
You don't need the humans in this. Honestly, no. You rearrange this back to maybe probably the way that it started, and it's just talking animals movie about a bear who, you know, has to find his nuts. Okay, yeah. Cool. You know,
you just have the animals help him instead of Eddie Murphy.
Right. And that's the thing, like the sense of heart, the sense of growth and everything that, you know, I don't want to shit all over this movie because they do something in it that saves it from being a total train wreck. And like I said, the performances are not bad. So, you know, so there's that. It's like I said, it's not 100% awful. It's just, it's not interesting, and I don't particularly like the bear character, and I'll get to Lisa Kudrow in a second. But the one thing it does do right, and unfortunately it misses an opportunity for Eddie to, for Eddie's relationship with his wife to be anything but an obstacle, and, you know, and a point of contention. And she was okay in the first movie. She was, you know, she was annoyed wife, and she played it well, and here she's even more annoyed wife. And it got old really quick. But the thing they do right is his relationship with Charisse. I like that Charisse is going through that awkward X-Men stage where she's just now getting her powers, but she's ashamed of them, and she doesn't want anyone to know, and it's causing her strife and angst, and it's putting a wedge between her and her family. And she kind of has to go through some stuff and get over that. And then it ends up becoming a thing that draws her and her father together. So it's like can we just take this movie and cut it in half and split them? And like do the bear thing in a different movie and do Charisse struggling. If they had just done, you know, Charisse resenting her father for being a famous mutant and her struggling with her own burgeoning mutant power, I think there's great stuff there. You know, I think there's great stuff to have been made for that movie. You know, I think showing animals talking to her and her not wanting to talk to those animals, things like that. Like, I just think there's so much of a better movie here with Charisse and her dad and her burgeoning powers than there is trying to get this bear laid.
Oh, Infinitely. And again, it would have felt more connected to the first movie.
Yeah.
If you're insistent on making more sequels after this, you could have even turned that into kind of a passing of the torch moment.
Right.
Because this was also not that far off of, you know, That's So Raven, when Raven Simone really truly grew out of being a Cosby kid.
And I think there's a third movie where she's a little bit older and she's stepping into that role, and her dad, you know, and the shift goes off of him to her, but he's there as sort of her Obi-Wan Kenobi, kind of guiding her through it, you know, and her foibles and her struggles. Instead, they're going to focus on the even younger daughter, Kyla Pratt, and she's going to do, I think, the next two movies, and then even she's not in the last one, from what I can tell. Or she might be. I have to look again. Doesn't matter. They were all director videos, and who'd watch them? But yeah, they lose Eddie and Raven altogether, and they focus on the less interesting daughter. In any case, I was bored by this one. I want to talk about Lisa Kudrow before I forget, and we start to wrap up here. So Lisa Kudrow is very funny. I know, if you're not into Friends, or if you resent the show Friends for any number of reasons, people resent that show, I get it. And I'm not arguing that you should, you know, that Friends is the high point of comedy and everyone should love it. That's not what I'm saying. But Lisa Kudrow, the actress, is very funny. And when you kind of take the handcuffs off of Lisa, I've seen her do some really wild and fun things on camera. And here, she's reduced to just a voice.
She can be so, so charming as the day is long.
Yeah, and she's nothing here. She's... If I had to say something nice about it, you know, there's some earnest there. I think she truly believes she's playing a bear. But... but other than that, it was like, you know, B-girl bear. Is there anything else about, like, does this girl bear have a personality or a character? Or you like hunky men. I could just see her, like, eye rolling in the booth. Like, ugh, well, they're paying me well. But that's it. They reduce this poor woman, and they reduce this whole character to just empty. And I say this without, you know, I'm not trying to sound like woke or anything like that. I'm not saying, you know, but I mean, like, all characters should be fleshed out. All characters should be well written and three dimensional.
Well, no,
the girl character should not just be this flat girl character, this object of, you know, this trophy to be won.
No, you're not wrong. I mean, hell, Mike Epps as Sonny has, I think, give or take a few, about a dozen lines in the whole damn thing, and it feels more like an actually realized character,
yeah,
than Lisa's main character focal point of at least half the movie.
Yeah, she's just, you know, it's funny. So Robert Winfrey got me hooked on this Screen Rant show called Pitch Meeting, and. You know, a lot of the times, the thing that he makes fun of when he rattles off the plots of these movies is they've been on screen, the male and the female character have been on screen for 5 minutes and they're already madly in love. But why? Because they're the male and female lead.
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of what happened here. You know, why is she interested in him? Because she's the female object of desire. Okay, but is there anything about her that wouldn't, you know, connect her to him? Is there something, you know... Is there a reason why she likes bad boy bears? You know, is there something intrinsic about none of that? It's just...
It fails the Bechdel test pretty miserably.
Yeah. You ain't just whistling Dixie. if I have to say something nice about this movie, and this is kind of be my final word on this, because like I said, Eddie Murphy is trying. He really is, but they don't give him anything to work with, and it's just blah. Him as sort of exhausted man coach. It's funny for 5 minutes, and then after that, it got old really quickly. And it's the same. It was the same gag for nearly 70 minutes.
this is Hitch with fucking bears. That is what we're working here. We're working with Bear Hitch.
I did like the resolution of the animals going on strike. I'm a sucker for a sight gag. There were some funny moments in that. You know, the horses not wanting to race and the jockeys riding each other. That was funny. Mm-hmm. You know, Shamu shaking his head and going, no. People dragging their pets who don't want to walk willingly, stuff like that. I mean, you know, after being bored of trying to man this bear up for 40, 50 minutes, and then to have this sort of the break into, you know, the animals rebelling, I was greatly amused. And it as much as I struggled to get through this movie, that made at least the third act bearable and fun to watch. So give me more of that. Give me more of animals fucking with their humans, and I'm happy.
You know, I just realized something else. Okay, try to follow me here. Mm-hmm. In the first movie, now I know that Oliver Platt was a bit of a sycophant, but can you name a true, consistent antagonist who maintained a grip on the entire plot?
In the first one?
Yes.
No, the situation is more of the antagonist.
See, and I think that's something else that I really enjoyed about it, is it's more of man struggles with himself.
Yeah.
And that's something else that you really don't see terribly many movies do well. And that's because they default to exactly what Dr. Doolittle 2 does. Because we're stuck with, you know, Eddie Murphy versus pre-kitty porn charges Jeffrey Jones and Kevin Pollak. We're right back to you know, plucky, moralistic, upright underdog versus the sleazy stock executive characters. Right down to, at one point, Jones snarling, what was the line? Oh, I beat the Democrats. Ah, that's fresh.
Had this movie been written 20 years later, he'd have been wearing a red hat.
Well, as it was, keep in mind, this came out right in the middle of Clinton's second term.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
Yeah, 2001. 2001 was Bush.
No, this... Oh, that's right. This came out in 2001. Okay. Yeah. First one came out in 98. I'm sorry. I got my dates mixed up. Yeah, okay, well... That makes even more sense. and instead of doing something that's the least bit fresh, and God, I swear I didn't do any research, but it wouldn't surprise me if I found out this was a case where somebody else submitted what sounded like a passable script. They just needed that one more key pillar to really try to prop this thing up as a moneymaker. And somebody came up with, well, why don't we find a way to work this into the Doolittleverse?
Yeah.
And we'll just reframe it with Eddie as a Dr. Doolittle sequel.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that that's probably what happened. Is they had a script lying around. They were like, "Well, you know, we can't do anything with this as is. But what if we, you know, but what if we use this for a Dr. Doolittle sequel?" And here's the thing: like, you know, when we started doing Long Road to Ruin 87 years ago, you know, we talked about how, like, you write a movie. You write a movie in earnest with, you know, with the best intentions in mind, you know, to make a nice movie mm-hmm. that people can enjoy, and you succeed, and it becomes a big hit. And you're like, great, cool, done. I'm like, okay, well, it made money, so there needs to be more of this. We need to do...
We need more dinosaurs.
Yeah, we need more dinosaurs. We need to do a sequel. And then it's like, they don't put any of the effort in the sequel that they put into the first one. That's you know, like, we call the show Long Road to Ruin because so many of these franchises, so many of these sequels mm-hmm. fail to capture the magic of the first one. And it, you know, and I think part of it is the mentality of Hollywood is, we have a good thing, don't fuck it up. So mm-hmm. a lot of safe choices get made. And it's like, okay, well, the first one was successful because of the cute animals that that Eddie Murphy gets to interact with. So what if we double down on cute animals? Okay, so we're going to double down on cute animals. How are we going to do that? What if there's a bear? What if there's a big, giant, cuddly bear? And I'm just like, my eyes are rolling in the back of my head because I can actually see their conversation taking place.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like you said, then they lose sight of what made the first movie so magical. Was your lead is great, and then you minimized your lead in the second movie, and it's like, minimized, he's on screen for most of it, and it's about the bear though.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, let me just say that before I kind of give my final words, there's a whole soundtrack to this. I actually like the music in it. The music was fun.
It's all right. Yeah.
You know, we have Cluck Cluck by Wyclef Jean. Do You Want to Roll, which is the Doolittle theme by RL, Snoop Dogg, and Lil' Kim. That was fun. Well, we have an O-Town song. We have What Is It Part 2 by the Flip Mode Squad featuring Busta Rhymes. Ah, Busta.
Mm-hmm. Bustle Bus.
Unfortunately, even though I'm going to do the plug now anyway, this is not available for streaming on Amazon Music. You have to buy the CD. But there are, you know what you can find on there? The soundtrack to Friday. If you want to hear Keep Their Heads Ringing by Dr. Dre and Roll It Up, Light It Up, Smoke It Up by Cypress Hill and Mary Jane by Rick James and...
Friday, John Witherspoon was in Friday. John Witherspoon has about a half dozen lines in... Dr. Doolittle 2. Boom. Connective tissue.
There you go. What a plug. What a plug. One of my favorite rap groups of all time, Two Live Crew, doing Hoochie Mama. Fantastic. You can get a free 30 days of Amazon Music on us to check all that out and whatever else your heart desires. At getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network. That's getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network. Get your free 30 days of Amazon Music, and then you can stream all the music you want. It's a great service. We use it all the time. We've used it on the Metal Hammer of Doom, as a matter of fact. I actually just listened back to our review of Tomahawk, where I went off on one of my ADD-addled tangents and started playing Imperial Teen. And lo and behold, the album I was looking for wasn't there, unfortunately. But I did find other Imperial Teen albums, and I made Jesse listen to it against his will, like I want to do. So... So check out a free 30 days of Amazon Music on us. I mean, what have you got? It's free. What do you got to lose? GetAmazonMusic.com/W2M Network. Lastly, and then I'll give you the final word, and then we'll get out of here. You know, we're talking about Dr. Doolittle. The Doctor is in for the Superblog team up, and there was less Doctor and more Bear, more talking animal here. You mentioned our phrase that pays, more dinosaurs. Yeah, this absolutely was like, hey, you know what worked in the first movie? Talking animals. You know what this movie needs more of? Talking animals. It was like, nope, they were sprinkles in a cherry. They were not the ice cream. The ice cream was Eddie Murphy, and you did nothing with him. And you had something. You absolutely had something with him in Raven Simone, and you did nothing. And then even the characters you did have and that you focused on, you gave nothing to Lisa Kudrow. You gave everything to Steve Zahn as Archie the Bear, but Archie the Bear is not a great character. He's just not. He's not somebody I particularly wanted to root for. I was like, I don't particularly want to see this bear get laid. I'm kind of rooting for Sonny. So kick his ass, Sonny. Show him what a real bear does.
Look, we never need the excuse to root for Mike Epps.
Fair enough. All right, you're the last word, Larry. Have the last word.
Skip this one. Just pretend that the entire saga ended with the first movie, because this was a cash grab. The whole direction of it was misguided, and I think when Eddie realized that, Eddie, much like Lisa, just kind of realized this paycheck.
Yep,
the check will clear.
I mean, it was 20th Century Fox, yeah, but it's on Fox. Yeah. You know, so before this was well before they got bought by Disney. So at one time they had money, and they hadn't wasted it all on bad X-Men movies and a Fantastic Four disaster. However, you know, all's not totally bleak at the box office. On a $70 million budget, it made $176.1 million. We're not the only ones that hated it. It has a 42% rating on Rotten Tomatoes and a B-plus scale on CinemaScore, which even though it's B-plus, and like, oh, if I got a B-plus in school, that would be good. Yeah, but B-plus on CinemaScore tends to not be good.
No.
Alrighty, so that's it. That's the Superblog team-up. That's Long Road to Ruin. Check out our other great podcasts on the network. We've got Damn You Hollywood for new movies. We've got more Long Road to Ruins from Sean and I, plus On Trials, depending on how we're handling a particular internet, how we're handling a typical franchise or property or whatever. So as the year goes on, there's going to be a lot more On Trials and Long Road to Ruins for Sean and I. I got, you know, towards the end of the year, I think I got Sean working like every week. So gear up for that. You can check out our previous ones in the archives, like for Mortal Kombat and whatnot that we did. Those were fun. And you know, we've got the Metal Hammer of Doom. We're doing more of those now. We kind of started off slow in the beginning of the year, but we're gearing up now. We got a whole bunch coming over the next couple of weeks, so check those out. And we've got source material. You know, every week we're looking at a different book. Sometimes it's related to what we're talking about with movies and TV shows, and sometimes not. And, of course, lastly is TV Party Tonight, where we look at an entire season of your favorite television shows and mine. So check out all of those shows here if this is the first time you're hearing us, because you've tuned into all the things that the Superblog team up produced today. Sean, what do you got going on? Where can people find your Twitch stream and all that?
Hey, short and sweet. Follow me on Twitter at Comer Codex. Also, Instagram, same handle. I'm posting on there a little more often sometimes. Lately, mostly, you know, food porn, workout thoughts, stuff like that. But if you want to see the really interesting stuff, you can catch me in my new streaming time slot. I am now streaming from 6 p.m. Central Time, a little bit earlier in the day, at twitch.tv/ComerCodex. This week, it's Sunday night as this is recording, so Monday night, 6 p.m. Central Time, you can catch me on there playing some Mortal Kombat. The next night, I am probably going to be giving Bioshock 2 a full restart, since it's been so long since I played it. I just kind of want to give everybody a chance to just kind of experience the whole story nice and fresh. And, yeah, we're just going to kind of keep rolling from there.
All right, folks. Thanks for joining us here on Long Road to Ruin. Also, check out our archive. Sean and I did this show from roughly 2013 to 2016. Pretty... Mm-hmm. Every other week, pretty steadily. And when I wasn't there, Robert Winfrey was there. And when Sean wasn't there, Robert Winfrey was there, or Sam Riccati, or Jason Offit, or Ben Colon. Pat Mullen in one instance. So all those shows are going to be steadily getting put up in the archives here on W2M, along with old movie reviews that we did before it was Damn You Hollywood, and old Metal Hammer of Dooms. So check out all of our stuff from the 2012, 2013 through 2016, before the great content share of 2017. It's fun to go back and listen to those old shows. Some of them are fun. Some of them are a little painful. Yeah. All right. With that said, for Sean Comer, I'm Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.